Good morning. Thank you for coming this morning, and welcome to the CSAS Conference on Demographics, Development, and Retirement Policy in Latin America. I'm Richard Jackson. I direct the CSIS Global Aging Initiative. My program looks at the long-term social, economic, and geopolitical implications of population aging and population decline in the United States and around the world. My co-host is Peter DeShazo, the director of the CSIS Americas program. I am going to kick off the forum today with a presentation that frames some of the main issues that we'll be discussing during the course of the day, and in particular, the twin retirement and development challenges in Latin America and the various ways in which they intersect. I think you all had an opportunity to pick up my program's new report on Latin America's aging challenge. That's also available in translation on our website in PDF in both Spanish and Portuguese. So, so much by way of introduction. Let me attempt to set up the day's discussion. You know, when people in other parts of the world think of Latin America, they usually picture demographically youthful societies characterized by lofty birth rates, large families, and chronic labor surpluses. The challenge is a population that's growing, that's too young and that's growing too fast. These popular images reflected reality in much of the region as recently as the late 1980s, maybe the early 1990s, but they're now hopelessly out of date. In fact, Latin America is in the midst of a stunning demographic transformation. The population growth rate has dropped dramatically from 2.7% per year in the 1960s to 1.3% per year in the 2000 aughts, and it's still decelerating. The number of children is due to peak within the next 10 to 15 years in almost every Latin American country, then begin to decline. The number of young adults in their 20s will peak and begin to decline almost everywhere within the next 20 to 25 years. By mid-century, the total working age population will be peaking in most countries as well. Meanwhile, even as the number of younger people grows slowly or declines, the number of older people will the number of elderly will explode. A generation ago, the problem was too many babies. A generation from now, the problem will be too many old people. By 2050, the UN projects that the elderly share of Latin America's population will climb to 18.5%, triple today's level. Now, that won't make Latin America the oldest region in the world by a long shot. By 2050, over 30% of the population will be over 30% of the population will be over age 65 in some fast-aging European countries, and in most of East Asia. But incredibly, several Latin American countries, including Brazil, Chile, and Mexico, may actually have populations that are as old as the United States. Now, there are two forces behind the aging of the population: falling fertility and rising longevity. The first force decreases the relative number of young in the population, while the second force increases the relative number of old. Latin America isn't the only region in the world now undergoing these trends. Like the developed world before it, most of the developing world is now in the midst of the demographic transition, that the shift from high fertility and high mortality, which is the norm in traditional societies, to low fertility and low mortality, the norm in modern societies, a shift that inevitably accompanies economic and social development. The demographic transition in Latin America began to gather momentum in the 1950s when improvements in nutrition, sanitation, and basic public health led to a steep decline in infant and child mortality. Since then, life expectancy region-wide has increased by 22 years, from 51 to 73. In Chile, where life expectancy reached 79 in 2008, people can actually expect to live slightly longer than in the United States. In most of Latin America, fertility fell later than mortality, which is what explains the population boom in Latin America. With birth rates high and infant and child mortality falling, population growth surged. Once fertility began to fall, however, it plummeted. Over the past three decades, fertility rates have fallen by at least half in most of the countries in the region, sinking beneath 3.0 everywhere except in Bolivia, Paraguay, and a couple of Central American countries with large indigenous populations. In Chile and Brazil, fertility has apparently slipped beneath 2.1, the so-called replacement rate needed to maintain a stable population from one generation to the next. In Mexico, where the fertility rate was 7 as recently as the early 1970s, it's now estimated at 2.2, which is almost identical to the overall U.S. rate and is far lower than the 3.1 fertility rate of the Mexican origin population living in the United States. Now, the coming age wave poses two fundamental challenges for Latin America. The first challenge is how to fashion national retirement systems capable of providing an adequate level of support for the old without imposing a crushing burden on the young. Graying means paying. More for pensions, more for health care, more for social services for the elderly. As the countries of Latin America age, they'll have to transfer a rising share of society's income from working-age adults to non-working elders, whether through public budgets, financial markets, or family support networks. In 2005, there were 8.7 working-age adults to support each elder across the region. The ratio is due to sink to 5.7 by 2025 and 3.1 by 2050. In effect, the average burden that must be shouldered by each worker will triple. Even as the old age dependency burden grows, so will the vulnerability of the elderly. Governments may be hard-pressed to maintain public benefit promises. Meanwhile, informal family support networks, which constitute the mainstay of financial support for the elderly in many of Latin America's younger countries, including Mexico, will come under increasing stress as family size shrinks and urbanization and immigration continue to break up extended families. The second challenge is boosting living standards while populations are still young and growing. Unless Latin American countries succeed in raising the growth path of their economies, they may have to pay for age waves of developed world proportions with just a fraction of the developed world's income and wealth. The future could bring widespread economic hardship, even a humanitarian aging crisis. Now, the good news is that Latin America still has time to prepare for the aging of its population. Now, unlike the age waves confronting the developed world, Latin America's age waves still lie well over the horizon. For the moment, population trends are leaning with economic growth, and in most countries will continue to do so for the next two decades. In fact, population trends have never been as favorable to economic growth in Latin America as they are today. and will never be so again. There's thus a crucial window of opportunity in which Latin America can strengthen its retirement systems and boost living standards. Let me sort of take these two challenges in reverse order and begin with the window of opportunity for development. When fertility first falls, the first thing that happens is pretty obvious. The number of dependent children declines, and it does so much faster than the number of dependent elders rises. This means that society's overall dependency burden declines as well, which is another way of saying that the share of the population in the productive working years rises. The favorable demographics of this phase of the demographic transition are sometimes referred to as the demographic dividend, and Latin America is now in the midst of it. Economists agree that the dividend brings potentially important benefits. A falling dependency ratio and a rising share of the population in the working years in and of itself translates or tends to translate into a higher growth rate in per capita income. Labor force participation rates may also rise as fewer dependents free up adult time, and especially the time of women, for participation in the market economy. Over time, as the transition progresses, savings rates may increase as more of the working age bulge, ages into the high-saving middle years. Smaller families may also be inclined to invest more in the quality of their children, and hence in the quality of the future workforce. These dynamics are not merely theoretical. There's a large literature in development economics which agrees that they've given a powerful boost to economic growth in East Asia, underpinning the stunning rise of South Korea and the other tigers, and more recently of China. Indeed, some studies conclude that the shift in the age structure of East Asia's population accounts for between between a quarter and two-fifths of the growth in per capita income in the region since the mid-1970s. The benefits of the dividend, however, are conditional. They're conditional on the social, economic, and political environment in each country. There's no guarantee that a country will leverage the dividend, and in fact, most Latin American countries have thus far failed to do so. Although the total dependency ratio in the region has been falling since the mid-1970s, economic performance has remained disappointing. Between 1975 and 2007, living standards in East Asia rose by 850%, while in Latin America, they've risen by just 44%. Even in the region's fastest-growing economy, Chile, just by about 225%. So the bottom line is stark. While East Asia is closing the living standard gap with the developed world, Latin America is not. Yes, over the past few years, and we'll hear more about this from today from people who know more about it than I do, it's important to note that over the past few years, there have been encouraging signs that Latin America may finally be breaking out of its low growth trap. From 2002 to 2007, the region's per capita GDP grew faster than over any five-year period since the early 1970s. Much of the credit for the turnaround goes to improved macroeconomic management and market liberalization, but also important is what Javier Santiso, the chief development economist at the OECD, calls the political economy a new political economy of the possible that marries fiscal discipline and policy continuity with social protection policies. So positive shift, certainly, during Latin America's recent boom. Yet despite the dramatic turnaround, the long-term economic future remains in doubt. There is, of course, the fallout from the current global economic crisis, which has already drastically slowed regional growth in 2008 and threatens to slow it even more in 2009. But much more worrisome than the near-term downturn are the persistent structural problems, which even when global economic growth resumes may make it difficult for Latin America to build on its recent progress. The macroeconomic environment in Latin America has improved significantly, but burdensome business regulations, punitive tax policies, and overregulated labor markets continue to undermine competitiveness. This slide shows two of the major global rankings, the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business Index, and a somewhat broader measure of competitiveness, the World Economic Forum's Global Competitive Index. On the latter, only Chile, in 28th place, scores among the top 50. From labor market flexibility and technological readiness to infrastructure and governance, the region as a whole continues to lag behind its major global competitors. Most experts also agree that Latin American countries misinvest in human capital, perhaps the most crucial input that has propelled the East Asian tigers into the economic stratosphere. Yes, most countries have made big strides in educational attainment, especially in universalizing primary education. But development economists agree that universal secondary education is the key to international competitiveness for middle-income countries. And this is where Latin America lags. In terms of quality, Latin American students also score lower on international tests like the OECD's PISA than students in other developing countries with comparable per capita incomes. Part of the problem may be skewed educational spending priorities. Most countries spend far more per capita on university education than on secondary education, the first, of course, which benefits a small elite, and the second, which benefits the masses. These ratios are the per capita ratios of spending on tertiary to secondary are precisely the reverse in South Korea and other East Asian countries. All of this helps to explain the large size of the informal sector in Latin America. Business and labor market regulations impede the creation of formal sector jobs, while inadequate human capital means that workers often don't have the skills to fill them. Across the region, the size of the informal market ranges from one-third to two-thirds of total non-agricultural employment. This high informality pulls down productivity growth, deprives governments of tax revenue that might be used for social investment, and leaves workers highly vulnerable since they're beneath the radar of social insurance systems. It's also a key reason why inequality remains so stubbornly high across the region, even in the region's faster-growing economies. Now let me turn to the retirement challenge and Latin America's efforts to build adequate and sustainable systems of old age income support. Latin America, of course, has been a laboratory for pension reform over the past few decades. Chile led the way in the early 1980s when it initiated a transition from its traditional pay-as-you-go public pension system to a funded system of personal retirement accounts. Since then, nine other Latin American countries have enacted reforms that shift their public pension systems, at least in part, to a funded basis. We argue in our report that these funded systems will confer important advantages as Latin America ages, or potentially confer important advantages as Latin America ages. I mean, at the macro level, they take pressure off public budgets. They can also speed the development of capital markets and help to maintain adequate levels of national savings, which is already a problem in Latin America and will become an even bigger problem as the old age dependency ratio rises. At the micro level, they can offer workers higher benefits at a lower contribution rate than equivalent pay-as-you-go systems can. This is because the return on a pay-as-you-go system is limited by the rate of economic growth, but the return to a funded system is equal to the return to capital, which over the long run, obviously a necessary clarification, is typically much higher, especially in aging societies with slowly growing workforces. Now, obviously, the global financial crisis and the plunge in world stock markets have given policymakers pause in some countries and are raising questions about the sensibility of basing old age security on funded retirement savings. One country in Latin America, as most of you know, has gone beyond questioning. Argentina, which introduced a dual public pension system with parallel pay-as-you-go and personal account options in the mid-90s, nationalized its pension funds last November and is now shifting back to a purely pay-as-you-go system. These concerns are understandable, but I believe they're misplaced. Again, retirement policy has to focus on the long term, and there's little question that over the course of a working life, Latin America's funded systems will outperform the pay-as-you-go systems they replaced, at least for workers that participate over the course of a working life. And in this slide, I just give you an illustration. Consider the case of Chile, where the net contribution rate to the personal account system is 10% of covered wages. At a 5% real rate of return, I think a reasonable long-term assumption for a globally balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds, a full career worker entering the workforce in 2010, contributing 10% over the course of a 40-year career and retiring in 2050, would earn a replacement rate of 60%. Now, the equivalent pay-as-you-go system, the contribution rate in a pay-as-you-go system to finance the same replacement rate would have to rise to 22% by 2050. Now, a 60% replacement rate may not be adequate unless a retiree has other sources of income. But if society desires greater adequacy, it could raise the worker's replacement rate to 75% with a 12.5% contribution rate. Whereas in a pay-as-you-go system, a 75% replacement rate would, by 2050, inflict a catastrophic 27% of payroll burden on future workers. I mean, and these projections may actually understate the cost advantage of funded systems in most Latin American countries. They assume 2.0% real wage growth, and the slower real wage growth, the greater the advantage of the funded system. 2.0% has been the historical record in Chile over the past couple decades. It's been half that in the rest of Latin America. Obviously, returns may be less than 5.0% on average in the future, but in fact, in the sensitivity analysis we did on these projections, the long-term rate of return would have to sink beneath 3.0%, which many economists consider the long-term risk-adjusted rate of return for the funded system to lose its relative advantage. Now, funded systems obviously subject workers to the ups and downs of financial markets. Economists largely agree, however, that workers nearing retirement can be protected from sudden financial downdrafts by prudent regulations that require them to move into fixed income assets at older ages. And in fact, a number of Latin America's personal account systems, including Chile's and Mexico's, are moving in the direction of this life cycle portfolio allocation. It's also important to keep in mind that even if you can't completely eliminate the financial risk of a funded system, you can't eliminate the political risk of a pay-as-you-go system. That is, the risk that future politicians will reduce its benefits. And this risk will grow exponentially as Latin America ages and the ratio of beneficiaries to workers soars. Now, none of this is to say that Latin America's personal account systems don't have some serious shortcomings and major structural problems, and we're going to be hearing a significant amount about that during the first panel. I mean, at the micro level, there's the issue of excessive administrative fees that eat into worker account balances. At the macro level, most countries are failing to realize the full benefits of reform. The impact on capital markets, I think economists would agree, has generally been positive, though it varies across countries. In terms of the savings boost, though, there's only real evidence that that's occurred in Chile. Other countries have debt-financed their reforms and nullified the boost to national savings. The most important issue, though, and Rafael will be talking about this this afternoon, is the limited reach of Latin America's formal retirement systems. And this, of course, is a problem that applies equally whether they're funded or pay-as-you-go. I mean, the large size of Latin America's informal labor markets means that much of the workforce fails to contribute regularly to the public pension system. Many workers, and in some countries the great majority, will arrive in old age with an inadequate pension or no pension at all. And not surprisingly, the low coverage problem is especially serious among low earners. What this underscores, I think, is the importance of a robust floor of protection. Many countries, from Bolivia to Brazil to Chile, with its new solidarity pensions now provide some sort of basic pension benefit to elders, whether or not they've contributed to the formal retirement system. Mexico, which still lacks a floor of old age income protection, will need to put one in place. The availability of these benefits may, to some extent, hamper efforts to encourage more workers to participate in contributory systems. But there may be ways to mitigate that, and I think we'll hear about that from Mario Marcel. In any case, a robust floor of protection is a social necessity. Now, non-contributory pensions, as I said, are a social necessity, but they're not a long-term solution to the old age dependency problem. I mean, if more than half of elders are still dependent on social assistance, on means-tested social assistance, or non-contributory social pensions, when Latin America's age waves roll in, the economic and especially the social costs will be enormous. In the end, retirement security in an aging Latin America will depend as much or even more on successful economic development as it will on successful retirement policy. Let me just very briefly wrap up by pointing to two different futures for Latin America. Down one path lies the future where Latin America fails to leverage its demographic dividend. A generation from now in 2030, if historical growth rates continue, living standards would barely have budged except in Chile. Rising old age dependency burdens would leave governments hard-pressed to care for the growing number of indigent elders, with incomes growing slowly and the average age of citizens rising, risk-taking, entrepreneurship, and mobility are likely to decline. as people seek to protect their economic and social privileges, inequalities in income and wealth could harden. Today's problems, in short, would become intractable. But then there's the path of higher growth and expanding opportunity. If all countries were to match Chile's historical growth performance, living standards would double across the region. If higher growth were accompanied by effective reform of business and labor market regulation and large-scale investment in human capital, the size of informal sectors would shrink as workers migrate toward new skill jobs. The tax base would broaden, allowing societies to undertake new social investments. Poverty would fall, and inequality, which has been the scourge of the region since colonial times, would steadily decline. The aging of the population would still pose a serious challenge, but it would be much more tractable. And finally, let me step back from Latin America for just a moment and put this in global perspective. If Latin America prepares successfully for its age wave, it not only will be more likely to prosper as it ages, but it will also be positioned to assume a much larger role in world affairs. Most of today's dominant economic powers and many of its rising economic powers are, in fact, due to age much sooner and much more than Latin America. You know, the 2020s is likely to be a decade of fiscal crisis and economic stagnation in much of the developed world as old age dependency burdens soar and, except in the United States, working age populations begin to contract sharply. In East Asia, you know, whose economic growth and geopolitical rise now seems predestined, countries will face a massive age wave that dwarfs Latin America's. Tax burdens will rise, savings rates will fall, and today's huge current account surpluses will evaporate. These global population shifts offer important opportunities for Latin America. If it can seize them, skilled labor will be in high demand in developed economies with contracting workforces. To the extent that Latin American countries master the outsourceable skills in demand by global corporations, they'll earn the returns in higher wages and living standards. Beyond the labor market synergies, there are also capital market synergies. By the 2020s and 2030s, many economists believe that the world will enter a new era of capital shortages. If so, Latin America's growing pension funds could become a crucial source of global savings that helps fuel global growth. You know, for much of its history, Latin America has been what the economists' former Latin America bureau chief Michael Reed has called the forgotten continent, and what foreign policy editor Moises Naim calls the lost continent. Beyond the main currents of global economic and geopolitical events, two or three decades from now, I thought it would be nice to end on a hopeful note. Latin America could be the indispensable continent. Anyway, thank you very much, and now let me turn the podium over to Peter. I think it would be better to take Q&A after we've both had a chance to talk.
Sure.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, and congratulations on a very excellent study. Very interesting. It's refreshing to be looking forward decades instead of being mired in the in the events of today and what's any given person in the region has said or is doing at the current time. The study and the excellent presentation you made provoke further thoughts about the political and economic performance of the region looking ahead. And I agree with the points you've made. I think what's most remarkable about this last 30-year period is the fact that Latin America has lagged behind East Asia so substantially. And the matter of Chile keeps coming up, the difference between Chile, the more sustained performer, and I think it's quite an interesting case. The CSIS Americas program did a analysis of Chile at 25 years into the Concertación government that took power in 1990, looking at the reasons and the lessons learned from Chile, both in terms of its sustained growth that outpaced the rest of Latin America, and also the problems remaining. And I think there were some very important lessons learned there on both sides that relate very closely to what Richard has been talking about. Indeed, if Latin America is in something of a sweet spot in terms of its demographics right now and its retirement systems are not particularly strong, then what can we expect when this demographic dividend tends to be reversed? And if we look at a country, even Chile, which is the best example, we see very low participation of women in their retirement system, still a large informal sector, very large administrative costs, et cetera, that complicate or lower the potential for the system to include more and be more effective. But the bottom line, and what Richard, I think, has very clearly laid out, is that Latin America needs sustained economic growth at much higher levels than the current performance in most countries. The past 5 years have been very encouraging. That's partly due to the very, very steep rise in commodity prices for many countries in the region, but it's also due to the fact that much wiser macroeconomic policies have been in place in most countries in the region over a period of time, policies that have encouraged investment, that have encouraged the growth of reserves, that have discouraged taking on extraordinary amounts of debt, that have encouraged domestic capital formation, and a whole series of other moves that in general have given a strong underpinning to the economic development of the past 5 years, and perhaps may shield Latin America from some of the greater travail as the world economic crisis continues to have an effect on those economies. They may be more resilient. I think they certainly will be more resilient than they've been in the past, even though they're going to be having to deal with some very significant challenges. But the weaknesses in the systems across Latin America, again, that Richard pointed out, I think are extremely significant. Lack of savings, low level investments, a glaring need for investment in infrastructure in many of the key countries, especially if they're going to be export platforms, low levels of competitiveness, which we've seen in the international ratings, very low investment in research and development, in technology, the quality of education that Richard pointed out, especially public education at the primary and the secondary school levels. This was a major finding of our Chile seminar. When we looked at Chile and we looked at why Chile had grown faster than any country in Latin America, why it had and how it had reduced poverty from about 38% in the 1980s to about 17% now, virtually eliminated extreme poverty, child nutrition, made huge gains in so many different areas. Why Chile persisted as one of the countries with the highest inequality in the region. And one of the key reasons was education. and not access to education, because there was an enormous expansion of coverage, especially primary and secondary schools, with virtually all Chilean students having access to and most of them completing secondary education. But the matter was the quality of the education they were receiving, especially as opposed to the middle class and elite groups in the country that attended private schools. And even in the private schools, the amount of education dedicated to science and technology was extremely low. In a country like Chile that has had a strong public education system for most of its tradition, to be in a situation like this only underscores the weaknesses in other parts of the region. Tax reform, other issues. One of the issues that we haven't talked about that is of interest, I think, looking at demographic trends in the region and in economic development is the issue of immigration. Latin America, only in the late 19th, early 20th century, had mass immigration from outside the region, and only in a few countries, largely Argentina, Uruguay, to some extent Brazil, coming from outside. Venezuela had a burst of European immigration when the oil boom was riding high in the 1950s, and the European economies were still devastated from World War II. But generally, there hasn't been much immigration into Latin America, and whether or not Latin America would ever be a magnet for extra-regional immigration is something that is worth considering. Also, immigration within the region, we see still large populations of one country moving into another. The large number of Nicaraguans, for example, in Costa Rica, Bolivians in Argentina, those kinds of regional immigration have taken place over time, and whether or not they would pick up as differences in development take place and what that would mean for populations in the region. But we generally think of Latin America as an out-migrating region. The very large number of Mexicans in the United States, other Latin Americans in the United States, increasingly in Europe as well, and what effects that will have, certainly the remittances that are sent back have made an important contribution in past years to the economies of Latin America, and whether or not that is a more constant source of income is something that needs to be taken into consideration. The issue of governance in the region is essential in terms of attracting investment, growing the economy, providing services, strengthening democracy. Issues involving transparency, anti-corruption, administration of justice, all of these are important. There are weaknesses in many of the countries in the region that need substantial correcting. There's right now in the region a trend in some countries towards more authoritarian, populist kind of policymaking that in the end will be harmful to economic growth, will inhibit countries from laying a stronger economic foundation for the future. Those kinds of political shifts away from more orthodox, market-oriented economic policymaking and strengthening of the institutions of representative democracy are worrisome, although, again, the majority of countries in the region have maintained good macroeconomic policies and are still dedicated to the concepts of liberal democracy as most of us would define them. So the region is in a situation where its political policymaking, its economic decision-making, its ability to break through some of the structural and institutional blockages to future growth are going to be key. And in most cases, these are political decisions. They're not decisions that that are driven necessarily by economic limitations. I remember Chile the first time that I visited as a student in 1970, and it was an extraordinarily different place in many ways than it is now in terms of the structure of its economy and kinds of in the way its government worked. It was much like any other Latin American country. It is not as though Chile was an exception in many institutional and structural ways in 1970. It had a more democratic tradition, but beyond that, it resembled so many other countries in the region. The changes that it made in the subsequent 39 years were remarkable, and I think, again, there are lessons to be learned there. But Chile needs to learn its own lessons as to what inhibited their further development. But there is, I think, an interesting chapter that needs further discussion. The region needs sustained economic growth. It needs it at a higher level. And it's only going to come from the kind of policy making that makes that possible. Thank you.
Peter and I would be happy to take any questions. If not, we'll have an early coffee break. No? Yes.
I'm wondering if you
are
interested.
Mm-hmm.
This question for Richard. Do you know, you presented a chart where you compared the pay as you go to the fund system.
Yes.
Do you know how charged you look once you include the solidarity pensions that are now starting to be more popular in Latin America?
This was a purely illustrative projection. I wasn't modeling the on the pay-as-you-go side. I wasn't modeling the cost rate of any particular existing pay-as-you-go system. On the funded side, the projection could have referred to. Any country with a funded system with a net contribution rate of 10% and demographics similar to Chile's demographics. I'm not the expert on Chile's recent reform of the reform. We'll be hearing more about that in the first panel. But my sense is that the new solidarity pensions will greatly increase pension receipt among the elderly at a relatively modest long-term cost, a significant but relatively modest long-term cost. I mean, the bigger point on I think the solidarity pension, because of its incentive structure, and I know Estelle James may disagree with me about this, but may serve as a useful model for other countries in the region. But the bigger point on social pensions that I wanted to make is that needs to be viewed, and I think this also gets back to what Peter was saying, this needs to be viewed as a sort of near-term and medium-term fix. But you don't want to, as a region, be looking at a long-term future in which the mainstay of retirement support, you know, for a significant share of the elderly or even the majority of the elderly, is means-tested social assistance. That is not a happy future. But I think that that the solidarity pensions are a positive development, and other countries have begun to move in that direction as well. Of course, Brazil did some time ago with its rural pensions. Bolivia has its bonosol. Thank you. Okay. Let's take a 15-minute break and then reconvene for the first panel.